What doesn't kill you makes you kinder.
When you think about life in those terms, it really tends to give meaning and purpose to your life.
As we begin a new year, let's talk about the worst and the best of human potential. I'm Susan Barnett, and this is 51%, The Women's Perspective. According to a Business Insider study, one in three students in America today is either a bully or a bully's victim. More than 70% of students said they witness bullying at least once a day. 35% of students are harassed online. And most students say schools do a bad job of dealing with bullying. The link between bullying and violence is clear, and this week we're going to look deeper at an issue which has only grown more difficult with today's technology. Jody Blanco was bullied as a young girl. It marked her for life, and it created her life work. The author of Please Stop Laughing at Me travels around the globe, educating students, teachers, and parents about bullying. Jody, now that we have the internet, there's a whole new way of bullying children. Tell us what bullying is like today.
First of all, bullying is not really any different today than it was 30 or 40 years ago when we were kids. The impulse for cruelty is the same. The group dynamic that motivates the behavior is the same because the adolescent mind and their emotional vernacular is the same. What's different is its weaponry to achieve it is far more sophisticated, and it cuts a wider and deeper swath. For example, 35 years ago, if someone wanted to start a nasty rumor about you in math class, they would write it on a piece of paper, fold the paper up, and pass it to everyone in class. By the time class was over, the paper would be matted and virtually illegible and tossed in a garbage can, and that would be the end of it. And by the end of the day, the students would pretty much probably have forgotten about it and moved on to the next thing. In today's world, that same nasty rumor could be posted on Instagram. It could be represented on Pinterest. A video could be made of it and posted onto YouTube. It could be emailed in one push of a button to every single student at the school. So the internet is sort of like a nuke to bullying. But the cruelty is the same. Kids were just as cruel to each other when I was in school. I know, I lived through it, and I've written a series of books about it. But it's just today, the internet makes everything bigger and makes everything permanent. And the bigger problem with the internet, even than the swath it cuts, is the anonymity. That's an even bigger problem. Because back when we were kids, because I'm 50, okay, so back when we were kids, if someone wanted to bully you, even if they wanted to do it passively, they wanted to exclude you, you knew who was your enemy. You knew who your attackers were. With the internet, a lot of kids can do it anonymously, so you don't even know who you're going after. Many schools say it's beyond their purview, and they don't want to get involved. So part of what I do is I educate schools about their legal responsibility and how they need to get involved. And those schools who don't, I take them to task as an activist.
Jody, I also wonder, the children who are shy or who are not part of the popular crowd, many of them live their lives, their social lives, on the internet. So does that isolate them even further?
Yeah, I think the internet overall may be a good thing for business, and it may be a good thing for certain communication expediency. But I think for teens, I think it's been a horrible thing on so many levels. First, kids don't go to libraries anymore. They don't get out of the house, and they don't go to research their papers where they see other kids and interact with other people. They do everything from the internet. They also tend to believe what they read in the internet. So the vetting process, the process where kids naturally and organically begin to learn what sources are credible and which sources aren't, has been completely diluted and almost obliterated. So there's a lot of other issues with the internet far above and beyond bullying that lead to less socialization overall. And, you know, the other issue about bullying that we should talk about is I'm 50, and I was excluded and bullied mercilessly from fifth grade to high school simply for being different. And now I travel around the country, and I speak at schools, and I speak to students, teachers, and parents, three different talks to motivate change. And my program, it's not just joking around. I've done it for over 500,000 people worldwide. And one thing I find consistently is that there's a new phenomenon in bullying called the adult survivor of peer abuse. It's always been there. I'm just the first one to label it. The adult survivor of peer abuse is an adult who was bullied and or excluded all through school, and they bear the scars. They carry those wounds into adulthood. It affects their relationships, their careers, their marriages, their parenting. It affects everything. And those people are now starting to seek help, because I've been, you know, pounding my chest about this for 13 years.
So let's say you're a parent, and let's look at both sides of this issue. First, let's say your child is being bullied. What can you do to help?
The first thing you need to do before you even talk to the school or talk to the parents of the bullies is find your child a brand new social outlet, completely separate from school, where he or she can make new friends with new faces that have nothing to do with school. Contact the park district, the local library, the community center, about 2 to 3 towns away from where you live. Research dance studios, drama clubs, music clubs, yoga clubs, anything for kids that's far enough away from where your school is located that if your child enrolls, they'll make new friends with kids who don't go to their school. This is vital, because this new activity will give your child something to look forward to, a lifeline. And once they're getting the companionship and acceptance they need from their peers outside of school, they won't be as desperate for acceptance inside school, and their classmates will eventually come around, because it's usually their desperation for friendship that pushes the classmates further and further away. Additionally, this new activity will give your child more social confidence. And the more social confidence he or she has, the less of a victim they will be at school. And it will also give you the time you need to deal with the school effectively and efficiently. The other thing I can tell you if you're a parent is, if you're the parent of a victim, the biggest mistake those parents make is they go into the school all gung-ho and they want assurances the bullies are going to be punished. That's not the way to handle it. The best way to handle it is to go into the school from a perspective of, we love all of our kids. These are all good kids. Let's roll up our sleeves and work together. And then find as much about the bully's backstory as you physically can. Because the more you find about the bully's backstory, the more compassion you're going to have for the bully. Kids aren't cruel just for cruelty's sake. Usually there's something going on at home, and they're bringing all that angst to school. If you can help the school identify what it is and encourage the school to be compassionate in their discipline and give the bully the support they need, the bullying will stop.
And what if that bully is your child?
If your child is the bully, what you need to do is realize that tolerance and compassion, patience, are not characteristics that you can teach a child or punish into a child. They need to be inspired by example, by the example of your own behavior in the home. So you need to start paying attention to your own behavior. You need to start pointing out to your child opportunities to be generous or kind. And there are two kinds of bullied students in a school, the overtly bullied and the invisible student. The invisible student isn't necessarily a kid who's even bullied on purpose or excluded on purpose. They just sort of disappear into the framework of the school. They sort of disappear into the woodwork. And what schools need to do is that they need to have counselors who are well-educated on both types of bullying. The schools need to do research about activities for kids outside of the school through neighboring park districts, private drama clubs, dance studios, So when a student comes in frustrated and lonely, they can sit down with their parents and say, well, I think the first step is that we should get your child involved in something fun and social outside of school. Because the biggest mistake that adults make that leads to more bullying-related suicides than anything else is they became so obsessed with getting rid of the bullying at school on an institutional level and punishing the individual bullies that no one takes care of the victim. And the victim's primary need, the one that if unfulfilled makes them at risk of suicide, isn't being bullied. It's the loneliness and the isolation. So the first thing everyone has to do is find that child a new social outlet where they can feel they belong someplace, and then deal with the bullies compassionately.
Jody Blanco is an author and lecturer. Find out more about her anti-bullying campaign, It's Not Just Joking Around, at jodyblanco.com. Coming up, remembering how it feels to be the new kid and unwelcome, and a call to be a hero. If you missed part of this show or want to share it, visit the 51% archives at WAMC.org. This week's show is number 1277. School days can be painful, whether you're the shy kid who doesn't fit in, the popular kid working hard to stay that way, the bully, or the victim. Chris Garnier shares a memory of childhood when she was the new kid, just trying to stay under the radar.
Gut instincts kicking in. Panic. Don't look back. My skinny body bolts. Faster, faster! I am no longer a wispy 10-year-old girl just testing out my brand spankin' new Ked Red highballs by jumping high and running fast. I am a wild-eyed jackrabbit blitzing through a field, desperately trying to escape my predator, a lanky Brill Cream bully named Tim Kettler. He may just beat the crap out of me this time, just like he has promised to do for some months now, ever since I moved into this awful new neighborhood. I take a darting look to the left of me, and to my disbelief, all of the kids on the block, traitors each and every one, have gathered on the Cramner's driveway, lined up against their brown paneled station wagon, cheering on my head-geared harasser. Get her! Get her! They chant rhythmically. I take another flash look back. Tim Kettler is far enough behind me. I may have a chance to outrun him. I muster up an adrenaline speed that convinces even my skinny, scrape-knee self that I can run when necessary and fast. Clotheslines fly past. A dog barks as I quickly navigate a maze of patios and swing sets. I hurdle a row of one of those squishy, red-berried bushes. Run! All I can see now is white lightning. Run! My breath labored, lungs heaving. The chanting fades, and I hear a lawnmower droning in the distance. I take a quick look behind me. No one is chasing me anymore. I realize that I have outrun the bully. I am safe, no longer hunted, haunted, and daunted by kids too tough for my see-through skin. I walk, bones wobbling, breathless, and cautiously relieved through the yards of somewhat familiar houses. I pause at a big wheat-colored field, the defining edge of my old neighborhood. My dad used to take me here to stargaze. I crumble into a heap between the tall weeds and swaying grasses, hidden, protected, still alive. I turn to lay on my back and watch one of those puffy white clouds roll and lumber across the endless, unceasing sky. I gaze up at a troop of birds now gathering in a row on a telephone wire high above me. They chatter and peep, sounding like melodic static. Breathing softly, sweetly, safely, cradled by the earth, watched over by the sky. Tears come gushing out of my eyes. I cry, relieved and grateful. Yet I cry, too, with dread. Because soon, I will have to go back. Back to where some invisible school district line separates me from the familiar cushion of my childhood home, and shoves me onto the other side, an uncharted, unexplained labyrinth of bullies, tough kids, divorced parents, and the inescapable initiation into adolescence.
Kristen Garnier is a writer living in Woodstock, New York, and she runs fast. This story was recorded by Chris Anderson at Nevesa Production. And finally, let's focus on the better angels of our nature. New studies indicate that not only do all humans have the potential to be selfless, to put others first, but doing so actually makes us feel good. Author Elizabeth Svoboda's book is What Makes a Hero: The Surprising Science of Selflessness. Elizabeth, the title of the book is What Makes a Hero, but as I read it, it felt more like a book about selflessness and altruism rather than being a hero. And what you found in the research that you looked at was that there are advantages to being selfless.
I think, you know, one of the things we have to do is sort of distinguish between, you know, what is a hero versus what is an altruist. You know, the traditional definition of a hero is someone who takes a risk to help somebody else without expecting to get any kind of reward back. And so you can see how traditional physical heroes would sort of fit that profile. But as I delved into researching this book, what I found more and more is that, you know, people who are altruists are also heroes in their own way. You know, they might not be putting their lives on the line on a day-to-day basis, but for instance, one of my mentors here in San Jose, Jeff Bornefeld, who heads up a mentoring program for disadvantaged youth, he's been devoting himself to this work for many, many years, and actually he lives in Portland, Oregon, but travels to San Jose just so he can run this program and help these kids out. So sometimes I think in our society, the career altruists and the people who are really at the extreme ends of altruism don't get acknowledged for the heroes they are. So that was one of the things that I really wanted to argue for, that we acknowledge the incredible effects that these people are having on our society. And in the past few years, there's been a lot of really interesting functional MRI research that looks at some of the neurological evidence for selflessness. And one researcher I spent quite a bit of time with is Bill Harbaugh over at the University of Oregon. And a few years ago, he did some giving experiments. He took his subjects, put them in the fMRI scanner, and he looked at what was happening inside their brains as they made decisions about whether to give to this food bank charity. And what he found was that when these people decided to make a donation to what they thought was a good cause, that an area of the brain called the nucleus accumbens was activated. And that was very interesting because that's traditionally an area that's associated with reward, with feeling good yourself. So the upshot of this is that giving to what you consider a good cause or something that's worthwhile, it feels like, you know, you're getting a gift yourself, like you're seeing a long-lost friend, something like that. It feels really good. And Dr. Harbaugh also found that the better we feel when we give, it's possible then we might want to give more often because we want to keep getting that reward.
In the book, you talk about corporate programs that help employees kind of rehearse responses, and you called it basically flexing or exercising their moral muscles to help them be ready to respond in a heroic way if needed. But you start off this book with an amazing example of a man who was teaching skydiving and who placed himself underneath the body of his student as they were crashing to Earth, saving her life and putting himself at risk.
Just to fill everybody in on the story of Dave Hartsock, the skydiving instructor that you mentioned, he was diving with Shirley Dygert, who she was a little scared. This was the first time she had ever been skydiving, and he reassured her, you know, I've done this hundreds of times. He couldn't be in better hands. But unfortunately, what happened when they were in midair and Dave tried to open the parachute to stop their free fall, that parachute didn't open properly. The backup parachute also failed. And so at the last minute, right before they hit the ground, Dave actually was able to use control toggles on his skydiving suit to rotate his body so that he was going to be directly underneath her when they hit the ground. Dave's body absorbed the brunt of the impact, and unfortunately, he ended up paralyzed as a result of that decision that he made to protect Shirley, which indeed he did. She recovered well and is now able to live a normal life. And I got to meet both Dave and Shirley in person, and it was one of the most amazing things to witness the bond between these two people. And Shirley most definitely credits Dave with saving her life that day, which he did. But, you know, when you ask him if he sees himself as a hero, he's like, well, not really, because I just did what I felt like had to be done in this situation. And, you know, I would have felt awful if I hadn't done this, because I think his deepest value was that he was going to do anything that his students needed, and that he was going to put their needs ahead of his own. And in this moment when he truly had to stand up for that, he was able to do it. And that I think is what's so incredible. Talking to so many real life heroes, it makes you feel better, not just about humanity, but, you know, about your own potential, that if you ever found yourself in a situation where you needed to help somebody else, even if you were putting yourself a little bit at risk, would you be able to do it? And I think if we sort of think through in our own minds some of these worst case scenarios, what could happen, and, you know, decide for ourselves what we might do, then in the moment we might be more likely to be able to do that, because sometimes things happen so quickly that we don't have time for contemplation. So it helps to think through some of these issues beforehand. I think that's certainly something that we saw with Dave Hartsock. He had already determined to himself, far before the day that he had to save Shirley, that he was going to protect his students' welfare at whatever cost. And so that thinking really served him well in the moment that he needed to call upon it. You know, ordinary people really can learn to be heroic. I think our definition of hero is expanding in certain ways, too. We don't just have physical heroes. We also have social heroes, people like Erin Brockovich, who let the world know when PG&E was introducing toxic chemicals into the water supply. So being a hero doesn't just mean, you know, rescuing somebody from a burning building. It can also just be standing up for a cause that you know is important, and you might be taking a personal risk as a result. It might be standing up at work, being a whistleblower when you know there's something unethical going on and nobody else is talking about it. When we've gone through something difficult ourselves, whether it's, you know, abuse, whether we've survived a natural disaster, sometimes the science is starting to point to the fact that that may motivate us to help other people later on who are going through a similar kind of thing. You know, none of us likes to undergo suffering, but when we do, it can be helpful, I think, to look at, is there anything that I can draw from this to help somebody else who's in a similar situation so that maybe they don't have to suffer the same way I did? And when you think about life in those terms, it really tends to give meaning and purpose to your life. I talked to Jody Blanco, who went through horrible bullying when she was in high school, and now she travels around the country giving presentations to high school audiences, you know, spreading this message of how much impact bullying can really have on people's lives and really inspiring kids to stop making fun of other kids. And she told me if she hadn't had this terrible experience in school, if she hadn't known how awful it really was, she probably wouldn't have done this with her life. So I would say, you know, think about some of the difficult times that you might have gone through in your life and ask yourself, can I get something out of this? Can I draw on that to give something back to somebody else?
Elizabeth Svoboda is the author of What Makes a Hero? The Surprising Science of Selflessness. That's our show for this week. Thanks to Katie Britton for production assistance. Our theme music is by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. If you'd like to hear this show again or visit the 51% archives, go to our website at wamc.org. You can also email me at sbarnett@wamc.org. Thanks so much for joining us. We'll be back next week with another edition of 51%, The Women's Perspective.